to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Is your recorder on?
Yes. Thank you. So today, recently someone sent me a short piece by Koho Nyamata Roshi. Koho Nyamata Roshi is a revered Rinzai teacher. And in this piece, he talks about what he considers to be the three essential conditions of Zen practice. So I thought I would talk a little bit about Rinzai and Soto and talk a little bit about these three conditions and how we understand them. So there's two main streams of Zen practice, and there's a long history with different names and various things that I'm not going to go into, but they're known primarily in this country as by their Japanese names, Rinzai and Soto. And this place is Soto Zen Buddhist. They're different in many ways, but they're like siblings, you know. They've been living together, they have the same parents, and they've been living together, squabbling together, talking together, exchanging together, going to family reunions together. Kind of, there's this, people sometimes split them up very separate, you know, and that's true, there's real distinctions, but there's also been a lot of overlap and a lot of exchange. So I want to just say that from the outset, because we're going to talk about some of the differences today. In Rinzai Zen, there's a very traditional form of practice in which there's each different lineage has a koan curriculum. Now, a koan, you may have heard of. Anybody here heard of koans?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there are different ways to describe koans, but one way to describe it is a story or a sentence or a question that is posed to you or that you pose to yourself that demands that you dive absolutely deeply into your life and into the nature of birth and death, into the nature of reality. Okay? And I'll give you some examples later. In this koan curriculum, a person would be assigned a koan by their teacher, and then they would demonstrate their understanding. One demonstrates one understanding to the teacher, and then the teacher either passes you or rings a little bell and out you go. So there is this sense of moving through a curriculum, and there is a real emphasis on specific experiences, what's called kensho. The idea is that you cultivate this way of engaging with your life, and what arises from that is an experience that transforms your life, transforms the way you understand yourself in the world. In Soto, we use koans too, but usually in a different way. First of all, there's not a set curriculum. Usually a question will arise in your life. What is the nature of life and death? How do I engage with a certain thing? Something will arise in your life, or your teacher can assign you a koan. But it's usually worked with less formally and less tied to having a certain experience or a certain awakening experience. In Soto Zen, we often talk about Genjo Koan. This Dogen Zenji talks a lot about Genjo Koan, which is the koan manifested in each moment. Life poses us a koan. So it's less about pushing towards a certain specific experience according to a structured curriculum. Rinzai then is often associated with the samurai spirit. And Soto is sometimes described as peasant Zen. Like, you just kind of go about your day, get up and feed the pigs, you know. But we need both. We really need both. And as we talk about these three essential conditions of Zen practice, we'll hear this samurai Rinzai spirit, and it's essential that we not only incorporate this spirit, but that we understand it in a sane and kind way. So these three essential aspects that Yamadi Roshi talks about are great faith, great doubt, and great determination. So the first one, great faith, Yamada Roshi says, is believing without any doubt that you are intrinsically awake. Okay? I mean, think about it. Already, right now, you are manifestation in Buddha's way. You are intrinsically right. You do not have to become something other than you are. He says, all beings are intrinsically awake. This experience that koan study evokes or returns us to, he says, seeing into your own nature means discovering something that you have already been using from morning to night. So whatever it is that you're discovering is already there. So first, he describes this great faith as believing without any doubt that you're intrinsically awake, that all beings are intrinsically awake. Second, that seeing into your own nature means discovering something that's already there, which flows from the first, right? And finally, trusting that if you ask for help from the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you will definitely get it. And that you should rely on the teachings and the teacher. So these are the dimensions of great faith. The fundamental one, though, is that you are intrinsically awake. And that seeing your own nature is seeing something that's already there, that's operating already there. He describes his great faith as thoroughgoing, rooted firmly in the ground like a huge tree, immovable in the face of the strongest gale. I was thinking about Hurricane Matthew, you know. Something that's so solid that even Hurricane Matthew will not uproot it. So this idea of faith challenges us to really look at our lives, look at our own minds, to see what is it that keeps us from this, and how do we cultivate it, or how do we return to it. And he points out that great faith immediately arises great doubt, which is the second one. So this is not intellectual doubt, and I would say it's not what I call corrosive doubt. Corrosive doubt is, I don't know if I can do this. I'm not smart enough. I'm not brave enough. I don't have enough time. Corrosive doubt is doubt that eats away at your sense of capability and engagement. So, it's not intellectual doubt. It's not corrosive doubt. It's a deep inquiry into the nature of the world, into our own lives. He says we can think of great doubt as utterly becoming one with our practice. Come on in, Elizabeth. Have a seat. We can think of great doubt as utterly becoming one with our practice, to the point where our entire body and mind are like a single mass of inquiry. So sometimes when crises come up or something happens that really discombobulates us, we can feel this feeling of what is this? What? You know, when we're faced with the death of someone, what? How is this? That's the kind of feeling. It's a way that we can't. Our wondering is cracked open, and it's not a matter of trying to answer a little question that we can answer according to the categories that we already have in our own minds. Right? This great doubt is something that permeates us and requires us to be alive to in a given moment. And he points out, there's no thought of becoming enlightened or of not becoming enlightened. There is only being completely naked and exposed. So, this great faith allows us, they kind of are, he says that, and this is often used, it's like a tripod, a stool with three legs is really steady. It's hard to knock it over. If you only have two legs, you can flop over pretty easily. In fact, you inevitably will. So, great faith, you can think about them as flowing from one another, but you can also think about them as being companions. So, great faith, great doubt, and then great determination. Spurred on by great doubt. This is great determination, right? We touch that sense of urgency, that sense of dedication, that sense of wanting to know, wanting for our lives to be transformed, wanting to engage. Great determination is a strong resolve that, as Yamada Roshi says, wells up from our gut. Yeah. A desire to discover. It's more than a desire. It's a sense of clearing out the clutter of all the ways that we distract and entertain ourselves. And really tasting that really desire to know what is the truth of this life. That what is the truth of this life? Again, sometimes when we're in crises or when something happens that upends our world, we can feel that. We want to know. We want to get to the root. What is this? That's the taste of great determination. Right. It's clearing out the distractions and really feeling that root sense. So with great faith, we have a sense, a kind of embodied sense, yes, already from the beginning, all beings, luminous, awake. Yes. How is that? What is that? What is that? It's like when we say, when someone takes the precepts, they don't say, you know, will you take refuge in the Buddha? Will you follow these precepts? The person doesn't say, well, I'll think about it. Or maybe, or I'll do my best. No, you respond with, yes, I will. Right? That's great determination. Yes, I will. I will live this life this way. So, these three go together. The great Zen master Basui says, When the living have become faithful, honest, and upright, and gentle, and wholeheartedly want to see the Buddha, these are the three conditions, right? This is when, even at the cost of their lives, he says. This is the nature, this is from the Lotus Sutra, but when the living have become faithful, honest, upright, and gentle, and wholeheartedly want to see the Buddha. Basui comes back at this. But, you know, I thought I'd say something about Basui. Here's a picture of a statue of him. He's got a really fierce look. Basui. He studied with Soto and Rinzai in Pure Land. But his he was known for teaching everyone. He wasn't an elitist. He was known for teaching everyone. And how he taught everyone, what koan did he give to everyone? Everyone. He was. Who is the master of hearing this sound?
What?
Who is the master of hearing this sound? Who is the master of hearing this sound? Now, one of the reasons I particularly love Basui and love this this question, this koan, is because it's completely portable, right? You can do it anywhere. You are not tied to sitting in a specific position, being in a zendo, going on retreat, doing any of those things. It is completely portable. And I think that's one of the reasons why he used it. He had bunches of people studying every walk of life. And he would pose this to him. Who is the master of hearing this sound? So one of the reasons I want to talk about Basui and mention who he was is because I think people often think about koan practice or this kind of samurai spirit or this great faith, great doubt, great determination, and kind of really construct a very militaristic view of it. But that's not the spirit of it. When the living become faithful, honest, and upright, and gentle, and wholeheartedly want to see the Buddha, even at the cost of their own lives. So remember, there's this gentleness in here. There's this thoroughgoingness. There's this to wonder who is the master of hearing in each moment with great faith, great doubt, and great determination is not, has this sense of discipline and vigor to it without harshness. With this sense, as Yamada Roshi says, no matter how high the mountains of the great Dharma are, no matter how deep the sea of ignorance is, they will be as nothing before the boundless spirit of determination. Regardless of what happens, yourself is from the beginning the spontaneous self-nature of Buddha. Okay, you want to hear that again? No matter how high the mountains of the great Dharma, no matter how high the mountains of the great Dharma are, no matter how deep the sea of ignorance is, they will be as nothing before the boundless spirit of determination. Regardless of what happens, yourself from the beginning, yourself is from the beginning the spontaneous self-nature of Buddha. So when we think about this, think about the gentleness, think about the thoroughgoingness, think about the moment after moment just dealing with what is, just dealing with, just responding to, engaging with what's happening in your moment every day. Not special. Struggles at work. Who is the master of listening? Driving in your car, sitting zazen, cooking meals. Who is the master of listening? that kind of determination is not, it can be too tight or too loose, right? If it's too tight, you'll just exhaust yourself. Oh, who cares? Who cares who the master of listening is, or the mistress of listening, or whatever gender you want to put on that? Our culture tends to revere comfort, don't you think? Everybody wants to be comfortable. It's kind of an addiction to comfort. Indulgence. And I think because of that, we can set up the opposite of it, which is a model of fierce effort that becomes a kind of spectacle, becomes a kind of larger than life, something special. Fierceness is like, I'm going to whip my legs into full lotus and sit all night. And there's nothing wrong with sitting all night. But real ferociousness is a dedication to our inmost request. And it's most often not visible. It's inner. It's about what we do with our minds and our hearts and our bodies. It's about the ordinary choices that we make. Sometimes large choices, but mostly ordinary choices. Often it's small, in the little nooks and crannies of our life. What do we choose to spend our lives on? Are we being guided by this inmost request? Do we place our faith in the Dharma? Do we question this kind? Do we cultivate this kind of questioning? That kind of ferociousness gives us energy. Do we refrain from anger and bitterness? Self-satisfaction? Avoidance? So, how do we actually put the Dharma in the middle of our lives? There's this word, ruthless. You know that word? Ruthless? Do you know that Ruth means compassion? A friend of mine named Ruth told me that. So, ruthless means without compassion. So, we want to be ruthful. We want our determination, our ferocity, our dedication to be ruthful. And that means that we include everything. And that means that gentleness, compassion, kindness are all dimensions of ferocity. They're not separate from it. Zazen is our roost, our home, the root, yeah. Placed where we taste this. But we never limit our practice to that. We take Basui as an example and we say, who is the master of hearing? You know, standing by the ocean, talking on the phone. I mean, we learn to saturate our days with these kinds of questions, with this sense of determination to make our lives, to live our lives close to this clarity and the root of what we really want our lives to be, our basic intention. This is demanding, right? This is really demanding. Because then there's no off button, you know, which doesn't mean you can't rest. But it's not like, oh, I'm going to go to practice and then I'm going to go do something else. Well, there isn't nothing else. But we ask, who is the master of hearing when we take Basui's instructions. You know, we're on the hook everywhere, as we say. So, you know, I would encourage you to think about great faith, great doubt, and great determination in this spirit of really making that investigation a part of your practice. What is this great faith? What is this great doubt? What is this great determination? How does that work? How is that? What is that in my life? This human life, not some other life. So that the gentleness is not sentimentality, which is basically a fantasy, or a lack of vigor, but is a part of the ferocity and dedication that we have. I wrote a quote down here that I'll end with by Thomas Merton, the great Christian author and contemplative. He said, "Evidently, it makes a great deal of difference with what spirit one sets out to keep a religious rule." Evidently, it makes a great deal of difference what spirit one sets out to keep a religious rule. So this is the spirit that we're talking about, is what spirit do we have in our practice every day? And consideration of Basui's way and this these three essentials that Yamada Roshi tells us about can be guides and helps. Thank you.